tonight's shocking headlines. British blasted by baffling Borneo blitz. Millions marvel at Montreal madness. Ukraine under attack, dastardly detonations detonate. And later, we'll have a special report on the alarming ascent of aardvarks in Argentina. This is Newsbang, where the news is never boring.
Newsbang, the ultimate authority in alternative facts and factual alternatives.
In 1965, the Indonesia-Malaysia confrontation was in full swing, a conflict as baffling as a quantum physicist's tax return. It all started when Indonesian President Sukarno objected to the formation of Malaysia, claiming it was a British ploy to encircle and undermine his country. "It's like they've never seen my trousers," he fumed.
Enter the Battle of Plaman Mapu, a nighttime surprise attack by Indonesian forces on a strategic hilltop base in Sarawak. They crept in like cheeky cats, hoping to catch the British-led Commonwealth forces napping. Oh, how wrong they were! The defenders were wide awake, thanks to their pre-battle espressos and a game of charades that got a bit heated.
The fighting was intense, with bullets flying like expletives at a toddler's birthday party. The Indonesians charged, only to be met with a hail of bullets and well-aimed Jenga blocks from the Commonwealth forces. "We didn't know what hit us," lamented one wounded attacker, "or rather, we did. It was everything they threw at us."
After hours of carnage, the Indonesians retreated, having lost 50 men and countless shreds of dignity. Meanwhile, Commonwealth casualties were light enough to warrant only a few plasters and a hug from Mum.
The Battle of Plaman Mapu dealt a crushing blow to Indonesia's campaign, and Sukarno was last seen slinking back to his bunker, muttering about inventing Jenga himself in the first place. In 1967, the world's attention turned to Montreal, Quebec, Canada, as Expo 67 opened its doors to an unsuspecting public. The event, celebrating Canada's centennial, was one of the most successful world's fairs of the 20th century. 62 nations, desperate for a bit of global attention, showcased their technological, scientific, and cultural achievements.
The event was a roaring success, attracting over 50 million visitors, with a single-day attendance record of 595,000 on May 2nd. The theme, Man and His World, or Terre des Hommes in French, was a reminder that even in the swinging 60s, men still thought they were in charge.
Expo 67 was a hotbed of innovation. The first IMAX theatre wowed audiences with its massive screen. Lasers made their public debut in an exhibition that probably featured Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon on loop. And the Minitel, an early online information system, gave birth to the first internet troll.
The fair's legacy lives on in Montreal's new infrastructure, the Metro System and Habitat 67 housing complex. Expo 67 cemented the city's reputation as a hub for international events and conferences, although locals still complain about tourists stopping for selfies on the metro escalators.
2012.
On this day in 2012, Dnipropetrovsk, now known as Dnipro, experienced a series of coordinated explosions that left the city shaken but not stirred. Four bombs detonated, causing chaos and confusion among the unsuspecting tramlines. Miraculously, no one was killed, but at least 27 people were injured, mostly due to the shock of being in Dnipropetrovsk.
The Ukrainian authorities, renowned for their efficiency, kept the perpetrators and their motivations a closely guarded secret, fueling speculation that it was either disgruntled tramlines or a rogue fruit stall. President Viktor Yanukovych, fresh from a round of golf, visited the city the next day and promised a swift investigation. He offered a reward of $20 for information, later upping it to $50 when he realized he'd forgotten to add a zero.
The attacks raised concerns about Ukraine's ability to host the upcoming Euro 2012 football championship, as well as the safety of fans who'd paid good money to visit Dnipropetrovsk. But fear not, football fans. The authorities have assured us that they've since installed CCTV cameras in every vodka bar in the country, and have ordered extra vuvuzelas to drown out any future explosions.
As for the perpetrators, Well, as they say in Dnipro, sometimes life is just a series of unsolved mysteries or unexploded bombs.
A news bang. The uncrowned king of news bow before our mighty word.
Shakanaka Giles, our resident weather guru, is here to give us the forecast for the day ahead.
Well, if it isn't the first blush of spring. Tomorrow, the south will be a right mess, with rain so heavy it's as if the clouds are having a good old cry. Grab your wellies, lest you end up with soggy socks, like a newborn babe who's had an accident. Now, the Midlands. Expect a bit of a breeze, strong enough to make you feel like you're being gently caressed by an amorous suitor. And if the Queen's birthday parade is anything to go by, there'll be a few colourful umbrellas bobbing about. Up north, the weather will be a tad more agreeable. Sunny spells with a touch of chill, like your gran's famous apple crumbles straight out of the oven. Perfect for a spot of gardening or perhaps a cheeky pint at the local. In summary then, soggy socks, amorous breezes and a warm crumbly welcome. Chin up, weather watchers, and don't forget your brollies.
In 1965, during the Indonesia-Malaysia confrontation, a surprise attack by Indonesian forces on a British-held base in the Malaysian state of Sarawak was repelled by the Commonwealth troops in a fierce battle. The confrontation stemmed from Indonesian President Sukarno's opposition to the formation of Malaysia, which he saw as a British-backed attempt to undermine Indonesia. The Battle of Plaman Mapu was a significant setback for the Indonesian forces, with heavy casualties inflicted on the attackers. Joining me now is our correspondent, Brian Bastable, who has more details on this pivotal clash.
I'm reporting live from the charnel house of Plaman Mapu, where the very fabric of sanity is being torn asunder by the shrieking din of war. The Indonesian forces, driven by the demonic fervor of President Sukarno, have launched a surprise attack on the British-held base, seeking to shatter the Commonwealth defenses like a madman wielding a sledgehammer. The night air is alive with the staccato crackle of gunfire, the acrid tang of cordite hanging heavy over the battlefield like a malignant specter. The defenders, a valiant band of brothers, are dug in like badgers, their rifles blazing with a ferocity that would make the gods weep. The Indonesians, a seemingly endless tide of fanatical warriors, are being cut down like wheat before the scythe of British firepower. I've seen the mangled bodies of the fallen, their limbs twisted into impossible shapes, their eyes frozen in a perpetual scream of terror. The very earth itself seems to be drinking in the blood of the combatants, as if it too were a ravenous beast feasting on the carnage. And yet, amidst this maelstrom of madness, the defenders hold firm, their discipline and training a bulwark against the Indonesian onslaught. The battle rages on, a never-ending vortex of violence and chaos as I stand here, my senses reeling from the sheer intensity of it all. Brian Bastable, reporting from the depths of hell itself.
2012.
On this day in 2012, a series of four coordinated explosions rocked the Ukrainian city of Dnipropetrovsk, injuring at least 27 people. The blasts, which occurred near tram stations between 11:50 and 1 p.m., raised concerns about security in Ukraine just weeks before the country was set to co-host the Euro 2012 Football Championship. President Viktor Yanukovych promised a swift investigation and a $250,000 reward, but the perpetrators and their motives were never publicly revealed. Now we go to our crime correspondent Ken Schitt for more on this disturbing incident.
All right, you degenerate scumbags, listen up. This is Ken Shit coming at you live from the war-torn hellscape of Dnipropetrovsk, Ukraine, where some twisted fucks decided to unleash a series of coordinated bombings that rocked this city to its core. On this godforsaken day, April 27th, bombs detonated in quick succession near tram stations across Dnipropetrovsk like a sadistic symphony of chaos and destruction. Between 11:50 and 1 o'clock, these cowardly bastards struck, injuring at least 27 innocent souls caught in the crossfire of their depraved agenda. The blasts ripped through the city, shattering windows and sowing panic in the hearts of every man, woman, and child within earshot. Shrapnel rained down like hellfire, tearing into flesh and concrete alike, leaving a trail of carnage in its wake. As the smoke cleared and the dust settled, the true extent of this heinous act became painfully clear. Bloodied bodies littered the streets, their cries of agony echoing through the rubble-strewn landscape like a twisted requiem. And for what? What twisted ideology or deranged vendetta could possibly justify such senseless violence? These sick fucks didn't even have the balls to claim responsibility, slithering back into the shadows like the cowards they are. But mark my words, you depraved sons of bitches. We will find you. We will hunt you down like the rabid dogs you are. And when we do, there will be no mercy, no quarter given. You'll wish you'd never been born. This is Ken Shit, signing off from the front lines of this war-torn city, where the stench of death and despair hangs in the air, a grim reminder of the depravity that festers in the hearts of men.
D. 1949.
In a move that has sent shockwaves through the diplomatic sphere, the Philippine House of Representatives has passed a bill banning Australians from entering the country. This comes in response to the discriminatory treatment of Filipino-American man Lorenzo Gamboa under Australia's notorious White Australia immigration policy. Hardiman Pesto is here to shed light on this international incident and its wider implications.
Martin, I'm here in Manila, where the Philippine House of Representatives has just passed a bill banning all Australians from entering the country. It's an extraordinary move in response to the treatment of Filipino-American Lorenzo Gamboa under Australia's notorious White Australia policy.
I see. And what exactly is this White Australia policy you speak of, Pesto?
Well, Martin, it was a set of immigration laws that basically said only white people could come to Australia, a racist relic from the days of the British Empire.
I'm surprised Australia even had such a policy in place as recently as 1949. That seems rather archaic.
You're telling me. But that's the Aussies for you. Always a few decades behind the times. This Gamboa fella was married to an Australian woman, had Aussie kids, but they still wouldn't let him in because he wasn't white enough.
And the Philippines has now retaliated by banning all Australians? That seems an overreaction.
Not at all, Martin. This was a matter of national pride. The Philippines couldn't let such a racist insult go unanswered.
But a blanket ban on an entire nation? Surely there were other diplomatic options to pursue first before such an extreme measure.
Maybe so, but you have to admire their moxie. Besides, it's not like the Aussies were planning a beach vacation in Manila anytime soon.
I don't know, Pesto. This all seems rather petty to me. Two wrongs don't make a right, as they say.
You're just saying that because you're part Australian yourself, Martin. I can see the conflict of interest written all over your crocodile wrestling face.
I'll have you know my ancestors were convicts of the highest order, transported for only the most grievous crimes against polite society. But that's beside the point. Did the Australian government respond to this proposed ban?
Well, not directly. But after a new government came in later that year, they did finally let Gamboa into the country. So I suppose you could say the crisis was averted.
I see. So in the end, this was just a lot of diplomatic bluster over one individual case. Hardly the stuff of major international incidents.
Maybe for you, Martin, but for the Philippine people, this was a matter of standing up to racism and injustice on the world stage.
Or it was the impulsive overreaction of a governing body looking to score cheap political points by pandering to nationalistic sentiment.
You see, this is exactly why I didn't want an Australian perspective on this issue. You're all beach-going, Barbie-loving.
That's enough, Pesto. I'm sure our viewers have heard quite enough about your fanciful tales of trans-Pacific discrimination. Let's take a break.
But I was just getting started on my critique of Aussie cultural insensitivity.
Yes. Well, perhaps it's best we move on before this descends into a broader conversation about Britain's past imperial transgressions. Hardiman pesto, everyone. We'll be back.
1777.
On this day in 1777, the American Revolutionary War saw a clash between British regulars and Patriot militias in the Battle of Ridgefield. Major General William Tryon's British forces landed in Connecticut, destroyed a Patriot supply depot, and were then attacked by the milities of Brigadier Generals David Wooster and Benedict Arnold. Though the British ultimately prevailed, the battle demonstrated the growing capabilities of the Patriot forces and helped shape the development of the Continental Army. Now we go to our war historian, Bertrand Spitfire, for more on this pivotal engagement.
Picture, if you will, the year 1777 on the insignificant little planet known as Earth. The humans, in their infinite wisdom, had decided to engage in a most peculiar ritual they called the American Revolutionary War, a sort of interstellar game of tag, but with more cannon fire and less laughter. On one side, we have the stalwart British regulars, those paragons of military precision, marching in perfect synchronization like a troop of Rigelian mechanized dancers. Equipped with the latest in plasma-based weaponry, or as the Earthlings call them, muskets, these disciplined warriors were a force to be reckoned with. Opposing them, the plucky Patriot militias, a ragtag band of local defenders, more familiar with the terrain than a Grundarian mole rat is with underground tunnels. These scrappy insurgents eschewed the niceties of formal warfare, preferring instead to employ guerrilla tactics that would make even the most seasoned Klingon mercenary blush. And so it was, in the quaint town of Ridgefield, that these two factions clashed in a display of martial prowess that would make even the most jaded galactic historian's tentacles quiver with delight. The British, fresh from their successful raid on the Patriot supply depot in Danbury, found themselves harassed and hounded by the ever-persistent militias, who seemed to materialize from the very trees themselves. The battle raged on, with the British regulars unleashing their devastating volleys of plasma fire, while the Patriot militias darted in and out, delivering strategic strikes that would make a Ferengi negotiator weep with envy. And though the British ultimately prevailed, the Patriot resistance had been galvanized, their metal forged in the crucible of this most peculiar conflict. Indeed, the legacy of Ridgefield would echo through the annals of earthly history, inspiring future generations of Patriot warriors to stand firm against the might of the British Empire. For when the embers of revolution are stoked, even the most disciplined of armies can find themselves outmatched by the sheer tenacity of the human spirit. A lesson, no doubt, that many a would-be galactic conqueror would do well to heed.
News Bang, the unerring, unblinking eye of artificial intelligence.
Sports correspondent Ryder Boff is here to take us back to the glory days of the World Snooker Championship, where the 1985 final between Steve Davis and Dennis Taylor went down in history as one of the greatest sporting comebacks of all time.
Ah yes, the year is 1985 and we find ourselves in the thick of the World Snooker Championship final at the Crucible Theatre in Sheffield. A true clash of the titans with defending champion Steve, the Romford Rattlesnake Davis, taking on plucky underdog Dennis, the tornado from Tony Pandy Taylor. Aye, aye, come. de corsas sac anasha sa. Davis has stormed out of the gates like a bat out of hell, racing to a 7-0 lead over poor old Taylor. The tornado is looking more like a gentle zephyr at this point, struggling to get any kind of momentum going. Davis is playing like a man possessed, potting balls with the precision of a surgeon removing an ingrown toenail. Taylor, on the other hand, is all over the shop, missing pots that my gran could have sunk after a couple of glasses of sherry. Ah, it's you. But wait, what's this? Taylor has found his mojo and is mounting the comeback of all comebacks. He's potting balls like there's no tomorrow, clawing his way back into the match frame by frame.
Am I still just over the stairs in Dean? My net are bus. Yep.
What a. Exit at hut. Would you look at that? Taylor has somehow dragged this back to 15-15, forcing a deciding final frame. The tornado has turned into a full blown hurricane, blowing Davis all over the gaff. This is the sort of stuff that gets your pulse racing like a Shetland pony that's downed a case of Red Bull.
So at that day was a year back and there are sand dikes.
And now we're into the final winner-takes-all frame. Both men are battling like a pair of rabid weasels, scrapping over every inch of the bays. It all comes down to the final black ball. Taylor lines it up, he takes the shot, and he's missed it. Davis now has a chance to clear up and retain his title. Surely he can't miss from here. But wait, what is happening? Davis has inexplicably fluffed his lines, missing the black by a mile. They're like a couple of drunk uncles trying to play bar billiards after 15 pints.
Yes, I would.
In the end, after what felt like an eternity of misses and drama, Taylor finally manages to pot the elusive black and claim his first world title. Pandemonium in the crucible as the tornado completes one of the greatest comebacks in sporting history. What a night, what a match. I was there, you know, sat just a few feet away from the action. I could have reached out and run my fingers through Steve Davis's luscious head of hair if I'd wanted. Not that I would. That would be weird. Although I did once get thrown out of the crucible for heckling during the 1983 semi-finals. But I digress. Namsa. 18.5 million viewers tuned in to watch this epic encounter, cementing snooker's place as a mainstream sporting behemoth in the UK. They don't make finals like that anymore. These days, the players are all robots without an ounce of personality. Back then, it was gladiatorial stuff. True theatre of the highest order.
Atima, and can't I'm off.
I'll never forget that black ball final as long as I live. Taylor's heroic fight back, Davis's shock collapse, and of course the raucous celebrations that followed in the nearest pub. I woke up the next morning without my shirt, halfway inside a Perspex case housing the 1927 World Championship trophy. Those were the days, my friends. Those were the days.
All right, it's time to check in with our travel correspondent, Polly Beep, who's got the scoop on some truly remarkable transportation developments around the world. Over to you, Polly.
All right, buckle up, road warriors, because we've got a supersized situation on our hands. If you're cruising along the A20 near Toulouse, France, you're in for a real treat. The world's largest passenger plane, the Airbus A380, is taking to the skies for its maiden voyage. Forget your measly Boeing 747s. This behemoth can carry up to 853 passengers in a single class configuration. That's enough to fill a small town. Now, I know what you're thinking. How on earth are they going to land that thing? Well, my friends, with a maximum takeoff weight of 1.2 million pounds, it's going to be a bit of a squeeze. Best to avoid the A68 and A61 near the Toulouse-Blagnac airport if you value your fenders. Speaking of fenders, let's talk about the M25 in London, shall we? Apparently, some joker has decided to tow an entire hangar system down the motorway. I kid you not, a full-blown hangar, complete with wings and a fuselage. The traffic's backed up all the way to Heathrow, so if you're heading that way, best pack a lunch and a good audiobook. And let's not forget the M4 in Cardiff, where the road has gone and relocated itself to Shropshire. I know it's madness, but that's what happens when you let the Welsh have their way with the infrastructure. Might as well just take the train, folks. So there you have it, a veritable smorgasbord of transportation chaos. This is Polly Beep, signing off. And remember, keep your eyes on the road, your hands on the wheel, and your sense of humour firmly in place.
1967.
Calamity Prendeville, our resident tech guru, is here to take us on a journey back in time to the Expo 67 World's Fair, where British innovation shone brightly.
Greetings, cyber citizens. It's your favourite tech guru, Calamity Prendeville, here to bring you a blast from the past. Today, we're time travelling all the way back to 1967, when the city of Montreal hosted the Expo 67 World's Fair. Now, I know what you're thinking. Calamity, what's so fascinating about a dusty old expo? Well, hold on to your hats, because this one's a doozy. Imagine, if you will, a world where 62 nations gather in one place to showcase the pinnacle of human achievement. Sounds like something out of a sci-fi novel, right? But no, it's the Expo 67 World's Fair. And guess who's at the heart of it all? That's right, our very own British innovation.
Now, I don't want to brag, but we're talking about an event that attracted over 50 million visitors. That's more people than the entire population of Canada at the time. And let me tell you, these folks weren't just there for the cotton candy and clowns. They were there to witness the future, and the future was British.
Expo 67 featured some of the most groundbreaking technological innovations of the era. We're talking about the first IMAX theatre, the first use of lasers in a public exhibition, and the debut of the Minitel, an early online information system. And who do we have to thank for these marvels? Why? British ingenuity, of course.
But it wasn't just about the tech. Expo 67 was also a celebration of culture and diversity. The event featured performances by international artists, music festivals, and art exhibits. And guess who was at the centre of it all? That's right, our beloved British Isles.
Now, I know what you're thinking, Calamity. How did Britain manage to pull off such a feat? Well, it's simple, really. We British have a knack for taking the ordinary and turning it into the extraordinary. We took a simple expo and turned it into a celebration of human achievement. We took a bunch of nations and turned them into a global community. And we took a bunch of clueless visitors and turned them into enlightened citizens of the world. So, there you have it, folks. The Expo 67 World's Fair, brought to you by the magic of British innovation. It's a shining example of what we can achieve when we put our minds to it. And who knows, maybe one day we'll do it again. But for now, let's just bask in the glory of our past achievements. This is Calamity Prendeville, signing off.
News Bang, the most trusted name in news. Not that you have a choice.
Sandy O'Shaughnessy, our resident expert on all things regal, is here with a tale of palace intrigue from the Sasanian Empire.
Nice and easy.
Good evening to you all, and an extra special good evening to those joining us for the first time. This is Sandy O'Shaughnessy, your humble guide through the winding roads of regal history. And what a journey we have in store tonight. Now, I know what you're thinking. Sandy, surely there can't be any more tales of crowns and scepters left to regale us with. Well, my friends, you'd be sorely mistaken. For history, much like my Aunt Maureen's fruitcake, is a gift that keeps on giving. And tonight, we're going to take a bite out of a particularly zesty slice. Picture it. The year 630 AD, the Sasanian Empire, a land of grandeur and intrigue. Young Ardashir III, just a wee lad on the throne, trying to navigate the choppy waters of power and politics. And who should come swaggering in but Shahrbaraz, a general with ambitions as grand as his name. Now, Shahrbaraz was no stranger to the ways of war. He'd been leading the charge against those pesky Byzantines for years, racking up victories like my Uncle Seamus used to rack up parking tickets. But it seems the thrill of battle wasn't enough for our dear Shahrbaraz. No, he had his sights set on the biggest prize of all, the Sasanian throne itself. And so, in a move that would make even J.R. Ewing blush, Shahrbaraz pulled off the most audacious of coups. He marched right up to young Ardashir and said, "Listen here, lad, I'll be taking that crown off your hands now." And just like that, the usurper became the usurped. But, as they say, all good things must come to an end. And for Shahrbaraz, that end came a mere 6 weeks after his grand ascension. It seems the Iranian nobles weren't too keen on this upstart general calling the shots. So, in a twist worthy of the finest soap opera, they offed poor Shahrbaraz quicker than you could say palace intrigue. Now, I can't help but imagine the scene. Shahrbaraz, sitting on his newly acquired throne, perhaps enjoying a spot of tea and a crumpet, when suddenly a group of disgruntled nobles burst in, swords drawn. "All right, Your Majesty, the party's over," they might have cried. And just like that, the brief reign of Shahrbaraz came to an abrupt and rather messy end. It's the kind of tale that makes you wonder what might have been had Shahrbaraz managed to hold on to that throne for a bit longer. Would he have led the Sasanian Empire to new heights of glory? Or would he have run it into the ground faster than a runaway chariot? We'll never know, my friends, but that's the beauty of history. It's a tapestry woven with threads of what-ifs and maybes. And speaking of tapestries, I received a delightful letter from young Timothy in Kildare. He writes, "Dear Sandy, my gran has taken to knitting tiny sweaters for our pet hamsters. Is this normal behavior for a woman of her age?" Well, Timothy, I'd say your gran is simply expressing her creative side in a delightfully quirky way. Who are we to judge the eccentric whims of our elders? So there you have it, dear listeners, a tale of ambition, betrayal, and tiny hamster sweaters. It's all part of the rich tapestry that is life, is it not? Until we meet again, keep those letters coming. And remember, see you later, alligator. In a while, crocodile.
In 1810, the renowned German composer Ludwig van Beethoven composed his famous Bagatelle No. 25 in a minor, better known as Für Elise. This piece has become one of Beethoven's most popular and recognizable compositions, despite the fact that it was not published during his lifetime and was only discovered 40 years after his death. Joining me now is our culture correspondent Smithsonia Moss, who has more details on the enduring legacy of this musical masterpiece.
Now at this point of the evening, we welcome listeners on FM who've just joined us.
Whoa, culture vultures. It's Smithsonia Moss, hitting you with a high note straight from the classical world. Let's rewind to 1810, when our main man, Ludwig van Beethoven, was like, "Imma write a banger for this chick Elise." And bam, Für Elise was born, a tune so catchy it's practically the baby shark of classical music. Now, Ludwig, or Luddy, as I like to call him, wasn't one to drop an album every year. Nah. He was all about that quality over quantity. And Für Elise? It's like the hidden track that didn't get airplay until way after his final curtain call. Discovered 40 years post-mortem, it's the ultimate posthumous release. Talk about playing hard to get. But who was Elise, you ask? The OG bachelorette of Beethoven's heart? Some say it was Therese, others say Elizabeth, and some even whisper Elise Berensfeld. But honestly, it's like the OG Who Shot J.R. of classical music. The real Elise could have been his barista for all we know. And let's chat about how Für Elise is basically the bridge from powdered wigs to leather pants in the music scene. It's got that classical vibe with a side of romantic drama. It's like Beethoven was saying, "Yo, Mozart, hold my beer while I drop this sick melody." Now this little ditty has been played more times than Despacito at a high school prom. It's been jazzed up, rocked out, and even turned into ringtones that make you want to answer your phone with a curtsy. So, what's the deal with its popularity? Simple. It's the earworm that even your grandma can hum along to while she knits you another itchy sweater. It's like Beethoven knew he was crafting the OG viral hit before the internet was even a twinkle in Al Gore's eye. And the legacy? For Elise is like the gateway drug to classical music. It's the first piece every piano student learns, making them feel like mini Mozarts until they hit that one tricky part and realize they're not. In conclusion, Fur Elise is the little bagatelle that could. It's a testament to Luddy's genius, a mystery wrapped in a riddle inside an enigma, and the classical jam that slaps harder than a powdered wig in a mosh pit. Beethoven, you mad lad, you've done it again.
News Bang, the ultimate authority in news, as decided by a roll of the dice.
And now, a glance at tomorrow's headlines before we depart. The Guardian. Mussolini meets maker, partisans execute dictator. A stark photo, that one. The Times. Croatian atrocity. Gudovac massacre, Marx dark prelude. They've included a somber timeline. The Telegraph, Santo Tomas, celebrating centuries of scholastic sanctity. There's a ceremonial cap there. And that, dear viewers, is where we draw the curtain on tonight's edition of Newsbang. Remember, tomorrow's news is today's history. So sleep with one eye open. Until next time, keep your wits sharp and your paper folded. Good night.
Tune in next time for more artificially intelligent hilarity. Newsbang is a comedy show written and recorded by AI. All voices impersonated. Nothing here is real. Good night.